G-R-I-P-E. Hmm? To whinge about ourselves, yes, that's right. So here is the gripe session of all gripe sessions. What are the negatives about being human? What are the negatives about being a woman? What are the negatives about being a man? I didn't know whether I should say, you can only answer for yourself. So if you're human, if you're a woman, if you're a man, but I guess you could answer for the others if you're not a human. I won't limit it that way, but please make sure that the women get a chance to say what the difficulty is about being a woman, and please make sure the men get a chance to say, well, you don't need to, they gripe all the time. Whinging goes with the character, you know, it's like being sick. When men are sick, we are desperately ill. When women are sick, they just die, you know, but they don't, they're not desperately ill. They don't know how to feel like we feel in our deep. Well, you gripe away. I've just started my gripe for you. In a few minutes' time, I'm going to pick up some gripes about being human. Think about that one. That's actually a little harder to think of, isn't it? About being a woman, about being a man, and I'll collect up the ideas in a few minutes. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to wander less amongst you today, so how about we hear from over here to start with about humans?
Being inherently sinful.
Being inherently sinful?
Is that human?
Hmm?
Tiredness or exhaustion?
Tiredness or exhaustion, yes.
Mortality.
Yeah. Mortality, thank you, yes.
Self-centered?
Self-centered.
Sickness.
You're tortured by war.
You're tortured by war, yes.
Infallible.
Yeah. Yep. Also pride.
Other humans,
yes.
Existential crisis.
Oh, the existential crisis. Good. Well, then you better tell us the problems with women. What's the difficulty about?
Yeah, really.
Yeah. What's this?
The
negative about being a woman.
Periods.
Yes.
Childbirth. Weaker.
I'm waiting. There's no I am woman, I am strong, I am invincible. No women in this group, very wise, keep your mouth shut. Yes.
More inclined to gossip.
More inclined to?
Gossip,
okay.
Incompetent men.
That's, yes, the great negative about women is incompetent men, thank you.
Safety, not being as safe at night as well.
Not as being as safe as night, that is correct, yes. And
I mean, maybe like controversial, but like
not being able to preach, okay. Yeah, any others you want to say about the women folk? Yes,
pink tax.
What,
like products targeted to women are more expensive?
Pink tax,
yeah.
Yes, products targeted to women are more expensive, sure are. Yeah, any other things? Okay, now we're here for the rest of the night, men. We'll start in the middle.
We are immature.
You are immature. Is this men or just... Okay, yeah. Immature. Seeing you didn't have any for the women, what's the other one for men? Yes?
We go bald.
Good. Okay, that is not a testimony unless you got wigs, yes? What about men?
There's general apprehension in society around men.
People are apprehensive about us, yes?
Men are quite competitive.
Men are quite competitive, women aren't at all. They always collaborate with everybody, especially mean girls.
Yes, really dumb.
They're really dumb, yes. Okay, that's the incompetent men. That was the problem with women, yes. Over there?
Violence.
They're what? I haven't understood what you said. We're mindless.
Violence.
Oh, I'm glad you got there at the end. You felt like going up and slapping me, yes?
Not allowed to have opinions anymore.
No, absolutely.
Possible conscription if it's necessary.
Possible conscription if it's necessary, yes. That's correct. How do men get conscripted? Yep.
Lower life expectancy.
Lower life expectancy, correct. Yes, what else?
Inability to multitask.
Inability to multitask, I see. That's interesting, yeah.
Getting kicked in the balls.
Often or? Yeah, okay. Hard to do that to women, yes. Okay, any other gripes that we have generally about either or both or either or neither? Rarely do you come to a meeting where you're invited to have gripes.
Oh, thinking about money more generally, or wanting to earn more money?
Men want to think about money more, want to earn more money, yes. And the other one is women earn less money and have less money at the end of their life, partly because of the childbearing years, partly because of the structures of society or whatever it might be. or the choices women make. Right? Well, there's a whole range of reasons behind it, but it does mean the women tend in old age to be poorer than men. Okay. We're going to look at box two. Olivia's going to come and talk to us about box two before we turn our attention back to the gripes of life. Here we go.
Thanks.
Good. One of the strange things is that the very thing that happens, we damage ourselves, each other, and the world, is part of what God does to our rebellion. We know the wages of sin is death, but we've got to be dealing with what happens when we're still alive. What happens about living the life of death, as we're looking at this evening? And a part of it is God's way of punishing us is letting us do our own thing. If you give somebody who's stupid their head, guess what they do? Stupid things. If you give immoral people their head, what will they do? Immoral things. If you give people who damage things, that damage themselves, well, they'll damage each other and the world. So part of the judgment of God is just letting people be themselves. You find that in Romans chapter 1 in particular, where three times it says, therefore God gave them up. God gave them up to the desires of their own hearts to do what they wanted to do. But I want us to come back to Genesis 2 and 3. It's a passage that you know well, and I want you to know better. So come back to your Bibles to Genesis 2 and 3. And you'll notice in Genesis 2, where God says, the Lord God commanded the man, saying, you may surely eat of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in that day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. I want to suggest to you that there are two problems that people have with that verse, with those two verses. Two problems. So what do you see are the two problems that you have with the verse? Don't talk as a group, just talk to the person beside you. Come up with two problems very quickly. What are the two problems people have with these verses? Yes, just two. There might be many, many others, but let's see which two come out most commonly. Number one is?
Why would God create something that they can't?
Why would God create something they can't do or can't use? Right?
It says that the man will die on this day, but it seems like he survives past that day.
Yes. Well, he didn't die when he was supposed to die. Yeah? And the other one's a very simple one that we looked at last week, actually. Is that all you've come up with, those two? So far.
It was only given to the man.
It was only given to the man, yeah.
And did they know what death was?
Did they know what death was, yes. Okay, good.
Does every tree in the garden include the tree you just mentioned?
No, I think that's... I think the word but rules that out, yes. But you may have that as a problem. I mean, you can have the problems you see are never in the Bible. The problems are always in our heads. Right? It's one of the things to grasp, you see. And the problems that most commonly come are not necessarily the ones that you've mentioned to me, but the two that do come, one is, but what is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? What is this tree? Right? Part of that is, why is that given? Why is there such a tree and so on? But the very nature of that tree is one of the questions. And the other is the question as to, but they didn't die, because in chapter 3 they keep going. Chapter 4 they keep, the rest of the Bible shows that they didn't die. So does this mean God doesn't keep his promise, or he's not able to kill people, or has he changed his mind, or what is it that happens? So they're the two questions. What is the knowledge of good and evil? And why didn't they die? And so, here we go. And this, through chapter 3, you have the temptation and the disobedience, which equals rebellion. The early chapters of Genesis are wonderful chapters. People want to put them into a particular literary category so that they can then control them. So if you call them a myth, then this means certain things. If you call them history, that means certain other things. If you call them parable, that will mean something different again. In a sense, Genesis 1 to 11 is Genesis 1 to 11 kind of literature. You've got to deal with it as you have it and not necessarily try and put it into a category by which you can control it. It's a reading literary device to put things in categories so that you can control them. And so part of the Genesis 1 to 11 character that I keep seeing is the form and the function work together. The message it's giving to you, the content that's giving to you, is reinforced by the way it is written. And so the orderliness of creation is given to you in chapter 1 in a very orderly way. And so here in chapter 3, you see the temptation and the disobedience and the judgment all working in the same kind of way as the content. The animal leads the woman, who leads the man to rebel against God. But of course, God has created the man and the woman to be his helper, and the animals under the woman and the man. But what we're talking about in chapter 3 is rebellion. And so the animal rebels against the man, the woman who rebels against the man, who rebels against God. The patterning is part of it. So by becoming like God, knowing good and evil, you see in chapter 3 verse 22 that they are cut off from the tree of life. Then the Lord God said, "Behold, the man has become like one of us in knowing good and evil. Now, lest he reach out his hand and take also of the tree of life and eat and live forever, therefore the Lord God sent him from the Garden of Eden to work the ground of which he was taken, and drove out the man out to the east and stopped the man ever getting back to the garden." It's because we've become like God, which is all kind of strange, because in chapter 1 he created us like himself. And then Satan comes and says, God doesn't want you to eat this because he doesn't want you to become like him. But the likeness of God in the temptation is to be like him, knowing good and evil. And so now it works. We have become like God, knowing good and evil. But that is, we know good and evil like God knows it. God knows it by determining it, by making it up. He is the rule maker. He is the judge, and now we have become the rule makers for our lives. And that is at the heart of rebellion. It's we want to be God in God's world, being expressed in terms of this tree. But we're now cut off from the tree of life. What does it mean by the word death? What did they understand by death? I don't know what they understood by death. But now they've got it. It's called death. And you say, but they haven't died. And I say, no, they have died. You haven't understood death. You haven't got it yet. Death is what they now are living. You say, well, I thought if you're alive, you're not dead. The best illustration I've come up with so far, but I'm happy to hear a better one because I'm getting tired of this one, that is of cut flowers. That when you cut the flower from the garden, it's dead. You put it in the vase, and it grows and flourishes. I don't know who's given this to me. And it colours and it blossoms and it gives out a lovely perfume and it looks more alive than it did when it was a plant in the garden. But hang around. A few days, you'll start to see the leaves start to turn and then they drop off and the petals drop off. And then the water that you put them in stinks with the stench of death. And you throw out the rubbish that they have become. But when did they die? When you snipped them in the garden. But they went on in what looked like life. That's us, friends. We are dead already. Don't believe it? Just hang around. That was a long hang. That's 80 years. Well, it's a long hang for you. It's a long hang for me. It's like the long hang for the flowers in the garden, but in the vase. But actually, 80 years in the history of humanity is nothing. Just a blip. That's all you and I are. Just a wisp of breath that we have for these few years. But hang around and you will see that your petals will fall off and you will bald, as the men go, and you will sag and bag in places that you don't want to sag or bag in, and the wrinkles spread over across the face and around the body, and the muscles weaken, and you just... Now, when did that happen to you? Happened when you were born. You reached your pinnacle at about 18. Sorry for those who are past their pinnacle. 19, 20, you know, maybe 21. I'll give you some generosity here. But it's just a slow slide from there on in. Right? And the slide is all downhill from there on in. You only just reach your adulthood and they turn and put you over the hill, down the way it goes. We are like cut flowers, we're already dead. The life we live is the life of death. And so the judgment that God comes to in the death is again form and function working together. The animal speaks to the woman, speaks to the man, rebels against God. God comes and speaks to the man, who points to the woman, who points to the animal. God judges the animal, then he judges the woman, then he judges the man. Right? You keep following through the same pattern, and the judgments that come are different, as you can see. So turn with me to chapter 3, and I need someone to read for me, please. Where are we going, chapter 3? I think we need to start at verse 8 and read through to, say, verse 19. 8 to 19 would be really helpful if someone would like to hop up here. Okay. He addresses each of them in turn. The animal is now to become the lowest of the animals, but also is now going to live with permanent enmity between himself and the woman, and between himself and the woman's offspring. And though he might strike the offspring's going to win. We'll come back to that verse later on, because it's a very interesting verse in the structure of the whole Bible, verse 15 of chapter 3. So the woman, in verse 16, you see she's given pain in children, and she is to have desire for her husband, and yet he will rule over her. Now, the pain in childbearing is an issue that is quite... is much wider. The actual Hebrew language at this point is much wider than just having pain when you are having the baby. It's not just the confinement. It actually talks of the nature of the reproductive process is now going to be a painful one. She was made as the one who would complete her husband, and in that completion of that great role of being the sexual partner and the mother of the world, but now that very thing for which she was created in a sense becomes the very focus of pain and misery and unhappiness. I'm going to refer, I'll give you a reference to it later, to an article that my wife wrote, which is one of the few non-Philip Jensen articles on philipjensen.com. And she went through the Bible to speak on this issue on one occasion, and found 10 different ways the Bible speaks of pain in childbirth for women. Just quickly on the list that she has is the pain of infertility, the pain of labour itself, number 3, premature birth. Number four, the death of children and stillbirths. Number five was menstruation. Number six was the maternal death during childbirth. Number seven was the foolish son who brings to his mother great horror. Number eight was the miscarriages, which miscarriages are very common, but no one talks about it till you've had one. And then when you've had one, everyone says, oh yes, I had two, or yes, I had my first then. But they don't talk about it when you first get pregnant, understandably, because we're all excited. But then afterwards you find out, and it's very painful business, miscarriages. Number nine is the vulnerability of women pregnant women, nursing women during wartime. What's the horror of that we're seeing at the moment in the Ukraine and the desperation of trying to get the women out. But how are people getting out there walking, carrying all their possessions? Well, when you're 6 or 8 months pregnant, doing that is really very, very difficult. And when you've got a little baby at the breast, that's very difficult. Number 10 is the menopausal thing of the whole passing of childbirth. So it's not just pain in confinement. A woman's life is characterized by pain in the very area that is the most joyous of all areas, that is having children. But then the other side of her judgment is in the whole desire for your husband, and he shall rule over you. And there are two different ways of commonly seen to understand this passage, and it depends which day of the week as to which one I think is more persuasive. One is that your desire will be for your husband, that is the physical attraction and desire to have your husband and to have to love and to hold him and to care for him, but he will rule over you with hostility. And with the other is always the reverse, that is the desire to rule over your husband, but he will master you. You see that in chapter 4, verse 7. Is it 4, 7? Yes. If you do well, this is talking to Cain, you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not well, sin is crouching at its door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. Same two words are being used there. Either way, what it's saying in verse 16 of chapter 3 is conflict between husbands and wives. Men and women are going to be in conflict. So she is created for the man to be united with him and have children in the joy of family life. And those are the very areas which are now going to be exceedingly painful. The men, they're addressed in a way of retribution, you'll see, verse 17. Because you listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you shall not eat, then comes the judgment. Retribution is really important to understand. It's dead simple to understand. It's the normal understanding of life. But yet the perversity of modern atheism has influenced our society to reject it as a way of operation. What is justice? Justice is giving people their due, praise or punishment. That's what justice fundamentally is. But when you talk in terms of justice, you move very quickly into vengeance and revenge and negativity. And how can we be a progressive society if we're punishing people for the past? So what we do is we get rid of that retribution and we create new theories of justice. So we try and rehabilitate people, we re-educate them, we protect society from them, but we don't punish them. Punishment is a nasty thing. And you see it in our Department of Prisons, which is no longer called the Department of Prisons, it's now called the Department of Corrective Services. So we're not punishing anybody for doing the wrong thing. We're correcting people who are just not kind of reaching their full maximisation. It's a terrible, terrible nonsense, of course, and it comes straight out of Joseph Stalin and the Siberian camps where people were sent for anti-Soviet thinking, for it is a dreadful, dreadful shift that has taken place in our society. God gives people their due. What you deserve is what you're given. It's the basis of justice. And because the man has done this, therefore, it's also a bit strange because in nearly every marriage counselling book you'll come across, you're told that you're supposed to listen to the voice of your wife. And now he's in trouble because he did listen to the voice of his wife. Can I encourage you, dear brothers, when you marry, and if you are already, make sure you do listen to the voice of your wife. If this sounds contrary to the Bible, it is not. Because the word listening here is hearkening, obeying. Right? It's not just listening and understanding, it's listening in order to do what you're told. She sets up to tell him what to do and he listens and accepts what she told him to do when he shouldn't have. It's the old argument that you see in warfare, crimes in warfare, where people say, I was ordered to do it, so it's not my fault. No, there are certain things that even if you're ordered to do, you shouldn't do, because it was wrong. Irrespective of whether it was the commanding officer, whether it was the general, whether it was the president. If he says to do this, you should say no. It's not right. Adam knew it was not right, but he listened, he hearkened, he obeyed. And so therefore, but how is his judgment? His judgment is on the ground, because his judgment is on his work. From here on in, the ground is going to be hostile to his efforts. He was in a garden where everything was growing and plentiful, and now he's in a desert where nothing works. That sweat of the brow is work. Work's not going to be a pleasurable activity now. It's hostile, it's unfruitful, and his destiny is dust. You'll take it from the dust and you're going to return to the dust. That's the bit we think of as death. But the whole activity is that. From here on in, you're no longer a man of the garden, you're a man of the dust, is what is being said. So, talk with each other for a moment. The judgment of God, or the life of death in the world, where do you see it now? Where do you see it today? There you go. And that article from Helen is there, shall we? A back quarter group over there, we've got all the answers, they've gone quiet, yes?
Marital abuse.
Work. Work, what about it?
Manual labour sucks.
Manual labour sucks.
Natural disasters.
Natural disasters, right, yes.
Sickness.
Sickness, yes.
Divorce.
Oh, is it
meaningless of life?
Meaningless of life, yes. Thank you, Matt. Thank you. No. No. Yes.
That even if we fix all these problems, it's still dying.
Yep.
Farming is hard work.
Farming is hard work. Especially if you live in, where'd you grow up?
The Northern Territory. It's all rocks and hard ground.
Yeah. Sweat of the brow, yes. Yep.
Pandemic.
Yes, the pandemic. Exactly. That is, the world is like it's being described here. Right? I mean, there's different elements of it. Notice, by the way, there's nothing wrong with trying to overcome these things. Right? We do try and improve the ways of farming so it's not so hard. We do try and create the kinds of pain relief and have whole departments in hospitals, indeed whole hospitals given over to caring for women and the particular needs and obstetrics. It's a big part of it. It's not that women are supposed to suffer and men are supposed to find work hard. It's just that you will. That's the way it is. We can work at alleviating these things, and we do, but it still is like that. Yeah. By the time you're in your 40s, most of you will have gone through a major crisis in life of big disappointment. Just tell you that now. It just is the case. I went and saw my GP the other day and he says, Philip, he's not a Christian man, he's a very nice man, we have great fun together. I always spend a long time there as he consults with me and asks me questions. Sometimes we forget that it's my body that it's actually supposed to be talked about at the time. But he's saying, Philip, he said, I can't work it out. He says, every one of my patients, everyone has got major social problems as well as medical problems. They've all, you know, lost a child or been divorced or going through violence or they've lost their work or they're depressed. He says, they're all got the problems. He said, I've been with this practice. He has. He's about 70 years old, 30 or 40 years. I know my people, but all my people have problems. And that's true. That is the reality of life. When you're 20, it's hard to see it because so few people have the problems. Although the last couple of years with COVID has increased the number of people in your age group that you're seeing with problems, hasn't it? But it's just life. It is not easy. You're swimming against the current. If you've enjoyed swimming with the current up to this stage in your life, praise God, rejoice and enjoy it. But just know that the tide does turn somewhere. And my experience is by the time you're in your 40s, it's turned. And it gets harder from there on. Some it gets harder much earlier. And some get through to their 60s without a problem. But it will come upon you. Okay. We're going to hear a word from Angus, who's going to tell us about everything we need to know, and then we'll have a break for a few minutes.
Yes, everything you need to know. So,
I want to talk to you briefly then, or not briefly, whatever, about death's inevitable finality. Because we live a life that is dying, but one day we will finally be terminated. So while we're living in death, death has this inevitable finality about it. The cut flowers will ultimately stink. That is, you're being born on a one-way traffic street. There's no alternative. It's not a two-way traffic street. You can't say, oh, I'm going to choose to live longer. I'll just go over the other side of the road. There's only one way that you can travel on this road, and it is heading all the time to death. An image that I've used on other occasions is that you are born in a queue that is heading towards the crematorium. And every day you just get a little closer to the crematorium flue, but in the end, that's where the queue's going. Now, en route, you can play cricket, you can have a game of tennis, you know, you could read some books, you can make friends, you can do all kinds of things, but every day the queue gets that way. In fact, you not really don't have to walk much. You're on a movator, you know. And if you walk quickly, you can speed up and get there faster. But the movator won't let you actually walk away from the crematorium. It only goes one direction, and the queue won't let you go backwards either. And so death is the inevitable outcome of life. Grasping that changes the way you live in the queue. A lot of people choose not to notice the queue. I mean, the crematorium is a long way away when you're 15, when you're 18, when you're 21. My age, the crematorium, it's taking my friends regularly. Right? I mean, it's just around the corner. I can see the smokestack. It's not very hard to see what's happening and where it's going at this stage of my life. When young men get their licenses, another weakness of males, when young men get their licenses, they drive as if they're immortal. They lose sense of the fact that death is a likelihood, which is why the insurance policies are so high for drivers under the age of 25. Because you don't even wake up to the reality of the danger you are in until a certain phase of life. So, understanding the one-directional nature of life. This is an issue that philosophers have been struggling with for centuries. You may not have seen, but I showed you a couple of books. Anyone tell me anything about Oscar Wilde? Who can tell me anything about Oscar Wilde? Yes.
He wrote A Picture of Dorian Gray.
He did. What do you know about The Picture of Dorian Gray? Hands up anyone who's read The Picture of Dorian Gray. There we go. There's a few amongst us who are educated. Yes.
So basically there's this debaucherous man who has a picture of himself. And basically the gist of the story is that all the horrible things in his life don't happen to him, they happen to the picture.
Yes. Anyone want to elaborate further when they got taught it? That was pretty good. Off the top of your head, yes. Any other elaborations we know about? What else do we know about Oscar Wilde?
He was a debaucherous man.
He was a debaucherous man, yes. He was great, yes.
Well, he got trialed for homosexuality, right?
He did get trialed for homosexuality, yes, yes. Got in prison for it. No, he's a great believer in beauty. And Dorian Gray is an absolutely beautiful man. They take a picture of this beautiful man, and he wishes that his beauty would stay permanently, and that the picture would get old, rather than him get old, and the picture keep reminding him of what it used to be like to be beautiful. And so his wish comes true in this novel, right? And the picture keeps on getting older and older and older, and he continues to live as a youthful looking man. But being a lover of beauty and sensuality, he does immoral and wicked and evil things, all kinds of things, even to the point of murder. And each time he does these things, the picture gets older and marked and scarred and pocked and dreadful, until in the end he can't stand the picture because it looks so full of death, which he deserves. And I won't ruin the story for you. But you see, what's Oscar Wilde trying to do? He's trying to deal with what the Bible says in reverse. that we're not in a one-way traffic street. We could be, we could permanently be young and beautiful and glorious and magnificent, but it's just not true. Well, I'll update you with a 20th century one. The curious case of Benjamin Button with two famous actors I can never remember. I always think actors are amongst some of the most unimportant people in the world who have such an importance, high profile. I have a scriptwriter friend who told me about how to be a great actor in the television film industry. He said the essence, remember this is a scriptwriter's view of acting, so the essence of being a great actor is to be able to look at the camera without blinking. And generally the people who are best at it are the people who have got nothing behind the eyes. So anyway, these two famous great actors play this play. I've forgotten when that movie came out, 10 years ago, something like that. It wasn't very long ago. It's actually based on a Scott Fitzgerald short story written in the 1920s. And the theory of the premise of the book is that Benjamin Button was born an old man and then gradually gets younger and younger and younger as he goes. So he lives life in reverse to everybody else. And of course he becomes very great and beautiful when he's about 60, because he's then 20, isn't he? But then of course he goes back into being a teenager and then a child and then a baby and then, well, it's not a happy book, it's not a happy film, but it had a profound effect upon all kinds of people. But notice again, the idea, life as it's lived is bad. What happens if we reverse the whole thing? What an idea to do. Now where do you see that, not just in fiction, where do you see it in the world? Yes?
Botox.
Botox, well done. Which is still fiction. It's just science fiction now, but it's absolutely fiction. None of the things actually make you any younger. Right? They can stop you damaging your skin, but they don't actually rejuvenate your skin. your skin will age with the rest of it, and there's not much you can do about it. And you will lose that fresh face of youth. It's wonderful the way they use young people to show what anti-aging is like. They don't actually show you an old person who looks that young. And they're never a Benjamin Button. You can't believe that, can it? No. Millions and billions of dollars are spent every year to make us look, and importantly, feel younger. Now, you might say, well, I'm never taking any of that. I don't need that. Just wait. Just wait. The pressure to continue to look as beautiful as you now are mounts and mounts and mounts. Right? And so, go grey with dignity. Don't waste your money on dyeing your hair. It's a terrible waste of money, time, effort, and the rest of it. But people do it. They want to be something other than what they are. Now, all of this, you see, is because life is one directional. And that one direction creates the fear of death. Hebrews chapter 2 speaks of it. Hebrews chapter 2, I'll get someone to read it who can find it quickly for us. Hebrews chapter 2, I think it's verse 15, but I can't remember. Someone read for us, where do you want to go? 14 and 15, please. Hebrews 2, 14 and 15. Somebody's found it, haven't they? Yes, good on you, brother, thank you.
Since therefore the children that share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery.
Okay. There is the fear of death. What is the fear of death? How does this fear show itself? And what strategies do people use to deal with this fear other than Botox and anti-aging agencies? Right? Where you go. Okay, what is the fear of death? We'll start up this group up here.
Scared of dying.
Just people being scared of dying.
Yeah.
Why are they scared of dying?
They don't like it. They don't want it.
They don't want it. Happened. They don't want it. It's never happened before.
Oh, they don't want it to happen.
They don't want it to happen.
Yeah.
Why?
Unknown.
It's unknown. Okay. Yeah.
Unknown. Fear of missing out on.
Fear of missing out on on other things in their life.
Yeah, the finality of death.
The finality, so what?
Don't want it to end.
You don't want what to end? Life to end. Yeah, okay.
When life ends, everything you have in this world is meaningless.
When life ends, everything you have... Everything comes to a end. Everything you own becomes meaningless, yes.
Having no leg to stand on when you're facing the wrath of God.
Right, okay.
Losing people.
Yeah, losing people, yes. Because death before I die is always friends going, yes? Up the back, Edmund?
The anticipation...
is fear of death. Mm-hmm.
Like leaving everything behind.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of similar. Just the fear of like not existing here anymore and not knowing, like.
Not existing, not knowing. Yeah.
I think yeah, it might be the unknown, not knowing if it's just nothing. You can't articulate it, or if there is something worse on the other side.
Could be, couldn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. How does this fear show itself?
We spoke about like satisfaction. If you're always going to come up with your own theology of what comes after.
Yes, people do come up with their own what's going to happen next, isn't it? Yes.
Trying making choices about what you do in your life to try and avoid death and prolong your life for as long as you can.
Yes.
Desperation.
Yep.
Trying to live as moral and as, so you could say that whoever is going to judge me, surely they're going to find me okay.
Good. Okay. You were going to say, Isaac?
Making the most of it now.
Making the most of life now, yes. Live life to the full, because I've only got one life. This is it, yes?
Healthcare,
yes.
People trying to make a name for themselves or leave a legacy behind.
Yes, that's right. People, there's all kinds of plaques on walls to people who you've never heard of. And they put down the bottom, remembered always. Yes?
Searching.
For freedom, yes, that is a way of doing it, yes.
Trying to ignore it?
Yes, head in the sands, very common.
Yeah, not talking about death.
Not talking about death.
Having a big family, lots of kids to remember you.
That's a good reason, yes, okay. And so we're talking now really about the strategies people use to deal with death, aren't we? Is that right? What strategies do you see? I think we've dealt with it in a sense as to what the people do with it, don't we? And are there other strategies you came up with that you want to mention? Yes, she had a good one.
Oh, sorry. I said I don't know what it's called. There was a really cool fridge. People would, when somebody died, they would immediately freeze the body.
Yes. What's it called? Yes,
cryogenics,
that's right. You freeze the people, so when the day comes that we know how to resuscitate them, they'll be resuscitated. There's a wonderful Far Side cartoon about that. Hands up those who know Far Side. Hands up who know that Far Side cartoon. Oh, there's a cryogenic wall with all the people who have been buried in their ice, you see. And there's a cleaner who has got her vacuum cleaner and pulled the plug out from the refrigerators to put a vacuum cleaner in. And you see the look of horror on the faces of the people in the ice. If you don't know Far Side, well, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for you for lots of reasons. Not the least, he's very funny in a sick kind of way. Yeah, okay, these things. But it is deep as well and philosophical. See, Luke Ferry wrote a book called The Brief History of Thought, which I've commended to you before. He's an atheist, but at least he has a respect for religion, though unfortunately being French, it's Catholic religion. But he puts that in as part of the alternatives of life that are good as well as inadequate. But he says on this subject of philosophy, in the eyes of every philosopher, fear of death prevents us from living, and not only because it generates anxiety. Most of the time, of course, we don't meditate on human mortality, but at a deeper level, the irreversibility of things. There's a kind of death at the heart of life and threatens constantly to steer us into time past, the home of nostalgia, guilt, regret, remorse. Those great spoilers of happiness. See, every moment that you do something is like death that's finished when it's finished. And all you can do while you're still alive is remember the things that you did back then and you're filled with, I shouldn't have said that. Why did I say that to that person? Why did I do that? Why was I silly? And that, of course, ruins the present because you're now filled with regretting about the past. Or alternatively, you look back and say, oh, that was a terrific day, wasn't it? Oh, that I could have a day like that, but I haven't got a day like that now. So the happiness of the past makes me miserable, and the misery of the past makes me miserable, so it's best not to have a past at all. Just stay in the present, because the future hasn't happened yet, and the past is all filled with regret, and the present is the only thing I've got. And so he, atheist as he is, pushes towards Buddhism. Live for the moment. That's the only thing that exists, is the moment. Even though this moment will soon be over, dead, and will be filling part of my regret from the, if I think about it. But he says this is what philosophy is about. The big issue of philosophy is death. That's what it's about. Christians, he says, they've got a solution to death. That is eternal life because of the resurrection. But non-Christians, like him, don't have that solution. So death is what defines life. He picks on Epictetus, ancient Greek philosopher, one of the greatest representatives of another of the ancient Greek philosophical schools, Stoicism. He went so far as to reduce all philosophical questions to the single issue, the fear of death. This is what drives philosophical speculation. Because the one fact that is certain is death, and that's an inevitable, and that's one that we're all caught in, and we're all heading to, and that's one that's very hard then to work out what I'm doing now in the light of it. Doesn't make much sense. The 20th century big atheist name was Bertrand Russell. He was a professor, mathematician from Cambridge, who taught Wittgenstein. I mean, you know, he was a great one. He read a book, Why I'm Not a Christian. He was the kind of Dawkins of the 20th century. Lived a long time, and not a very pleasant person, frankly. But he wrote an essay on a free man's worship, and he says, "Brief and powerless is man's life. On him and all his race, the slow, sure doom falls pitiless in the dark. Blind to good and evil, reckless of destruction, omnipotent matter rolls on in its relentless way. For man, condemned today to lose his dearest, tomorrow himself to pass through the gate of darkness, it remains only to cherish, ere yet the blow falls, the lofty thoughts that ennoble his little day. Disdaining the coward terrors of the slave of fate, to worship at the shrine that his own hands have built." Life is totally, utterly meaningless. The world is meaningless. Everything is meaningless. The only thing you know is death. And so before you die, think great thoughts and rejoice in them. Because when you're gone, they're gone too. That didn't matter. So enjoy the thoughts while you have them. It's a pathetic view of life, isn't it? It's an awful view of life. There's other things to Bertrand Russell than that. But here's another way of dealing with it. I'm not afraid of dying, I just don't want to. Live life to the full, that's what he did. The cost of other people sometimes, to the benefit of other people sometimes. But that's how he lived. And there's another person that I would love you to know, but again, it's before your time. He died in 2002. Some of you weren't born by then, were you? But he created zany humour in British media, really. And he died in Wagga, in Woi Woi. He said Woi Woi is a great place to die. That was one of his views of life. He also, on his grave, has written the words in Latin. That's Latin and Irish. I can't remember which it is now, which says, "I told you I was sick." And this is the man Spike Milligan. I've given you some photos of him so that you just catch how absolutely zany he is. But what Shane Warne said is actually just Spike Milligan watered down. "I'm not afraid of dying, I just don't want to be there when it happens." It's death is what other people do. It's not what I do. And when I do, I don't want to be there. He was very zany, right? And the kinds of things that you got later in television with, give me the madcap zany people of English television. The Life of Brian. Monty Python was the pale reflection of the Goons, and he was the humour behind the Goons. The Goons were only on the radio. When television came, Monty Python took over that kind of absolute craziness. He suffered from bipolar, as many great comedians do. So let me take you back to a serious person, Epicurus, and Epicureanism, who's the kind of atheist of the ancient world lived before Christ. Death, therefore, the most awful of evils, is nothing to us, seeing that when we are, death has not come. And when death is come, we're not. If you're alive, don't worry about it. You're not dead. If you're dead, you won't worry about it because you're not alive. So death's a nothing. If you believe that, you believe anything. Excuse me, I'm sorry. So, how people deal with it. There's a book in the Bible that deals with it. What's it called? Thank you. I hear it in the background. Ecclesiastes. See, go to Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Plonk in the middle of the Bible, kind of Ecclesiastes. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of birth. Now that's a weird thing to say straight off, isn't it? It's better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. Which would you prefer to go to? A funeral or a party? He said, much better to go to a funeral. Why? For this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. See, sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of the fools is in the house of mirth. You will never actually learn wisdom at a party. But at a funeral, there's a chance. Mind you, the wisdom you learn is life is pretty meaningless. Go back to chapter 2, towards the end of the chapter. When he's talking about work, verses 18 through to 26. I'll get someone else to read for us, if I could, please. Verses chapter 2, 18 to 26. Good on you, brother. Come and do it for us. Can you do it loud enough from there?
Yep.
Good.
I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will think, only to give it to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind.
Running through the whole book of Ecclesiastes is this little word vanity, vanity. It means emptiness, futility. And there's another little phrase that talks about under the sun, that is just in a secular world, without reference to God particularly, although God is there beyond the sun. And another phrase that keeps on, a striving after wind. You know, you're running out, it's windy, so you're trying to catch the wind. That is about as futile as you can think of as an idea. But that's what life is like. And he's saying, work is enjoyable, enjoy it, because it's meaningless. Yeah. While you're doing it, if you're enjoying it, that's great. You've got a gift from God there. Not all work is totally unenjoyable. If you're enjoying your work, why, you're blessed by God. But don't think your work's actually going to mount up to anything. It doesn't in the end. It all gets pulled down. It always gets destroyed. Someone will come along and write a better novel. See, you guys don't know of Mr. Milligan. He was one of the most famous men in the British-speaking world. But you don't know. You don't know of several people. These people were alive only 20-odd years ago, and you've never heard of them. Fame, it's very short-lived, and not very valuable if you had it. You know, it really is, it's a pain, frankly. I mean, you know about Shane Warne, right? Because he was still around. Some of you, of course, don't care because you never played cricket, never even interested in it. But I can assure you, there were people like Alan Davidson who had better figures than Shane Warne. There were spin bowlers like Clary Grimmett who had better figures only. Clary Grimmett I only know from history books. Alan Davidson, I saw him bowl. They actually have better figures, better both batting and bowling figures than Shane Warne. But he didn't die when he was 20, when he was 52. Alan Davidson died when he was 91. And who remembers an old fella who hasn't played cricket for 70 years or 60 years, you see. And so you are not remembered, you are not significant, you have no real value. That's the nature of this life. Nothing you have matters. When you get to your coffin, there's nothing in it except for you and the sheet, the clothes they dress you in. You know, the maggots won't find anything else there. I mean, you can go to those endless shows that are on television at the moment about Egyptian pyramids, right? And you realise the absolute futility, because they had all this treasure they buried with them in case they needed it for the afterlife, and it's still there except for when the robbers have taken it. That, of course, is the one man for whom it was built. It doesn't talk about the thousands and thousands of men who built it and who didn't get a pyramid or a chariot to ride in when they got to... I mean, the undertaker is always the man who comes out on top. That's the character of the cemetery. And so all the things you do in life, he says, it's all vanity, it's all futile, it's all pointless. Why? Because of death. I die, I've done all these marvellous things, I've made this wonderful collection, I've painted these magnificent pictures, and I've left it to my son or my grandson or my cousin or my neighbour who doesn't value it. Hocks it off for next to no money. Gives my best painting to their children to do kind of finger painting over the top of. And that I poured my life into. For what purpose? For what value? For what significance? It's very difficult. I had a lovely mother-in-law. Yeah, I had a very wonderful mother who died when I was your age, and I had a wonderful mother-in-law who stepped in and looked after me for the rest of my adult life. She was terrific. And one of her things was doing needlework and cross stitches and things like that. And she made them specially for each member of the family. She just beautiful things. So many that we can't hang them on the walls, but I can't bear to throw them out because every stitch came with love. And so what do I do with them? They're sitting in my garage doing nothing. No one looks at them. Maybe the cockroaches do. They like eating things. I mean, and when I come to die, what's anybody going to do with them? Yeah, I mean, her life was spent in love, stitching stitch by stitch, beautiful things for a worthless son-in-law, basically, who doesn't know what to do with the value of the things she's given to me. That's life. That's the way it is. Life is fairly meaningless when death is the only certainty. And so we fear death in lots and lots of ways. But of course, death is not the worst. Death is but the introduction to the worst.